Hey there, dudes and dudettes, and welcome to Tubular Time Machine, the podcast that cranks the nostalgia dial all the way to 11. I'm your host, Jason Raz Rasmussen, and each week we jump into our gnarly retro ride and rocket back to a specific year between 1971 and 2000, reliving the raddest music, movies, TV shows, video games, toys, slang, and pop culture moments that make growing up in the United States so totally bodacious. But I'm not flying solo. Every episode features a special co-host who is exactly 14 years old that year, ready to dish on everything from mixtapes and mall food courts to butterfly clips and blowing into NES cartridges like a wizard. So grab your slap bracelet, rewind your cassette, and fire up the Tubular Time Machine theme song, where the past is always rad and the vibes never go out of style. This week on Tubular Time Machine, we're throwing it back to 1974. Bell bottoms, Watergate, and pop rocks. Oh my. And joining me in the time machine is someone who is right there in the thick of it, not in Washington, but in the ninth grade. Please welcome Bruce Cole, a seasoned educator with 23 years under his belt in business, marketing, and information technology. Bruce is heading into retirement this year, but not before taking us on a trip down memory lane. When he's not in the classroom, Bruce is a proud golden doodle breeder and full-time dog lover. This week, he's stepping back in time to tell us what it was like being 14 years old in 1974. From the music and movies to the fads he couldn't live without. Bruce, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jason. How are you?
Oh, so far it's been a great day. How about you?
Oh, me too. It's just so pretty, and I'm enjoying springtime and looking forward to two more weeks in the classroom and being a short timer.
Two more weeks. I can't even begin to imagine two more weeks, sadly.
Well, see, the thing is, when you look back at being 14 in 1974, it lets you realize you deserve to be looking at retiring in 2025.
You're just old.
No, old's a state of mind. Instead, you're well seasoned.
Okay, we'll just call it that. Yep.
So last week I had the pleasure of going forward and actually had one of my old students from college doing 2009, which is the tail end of my list of years that I'm doing. And this time, of course, we're going back to 1974, almost the beginning of my timeline. And this was when I was a whole whopping 3 years old. So this is going to be an interesting one because I'll get to learn a little about when I was a wee one.
Yeah, and it should be fun. As I was thinking about this, as we've been talking about preparing for the show and things like that, I kept asking myself, how much do I really remember from 1974? How much was really a part of my life? I think I had mentioned to you, I wasn't allowed to go to movies. So movies I saw were usually either something surreptitious or something that I happened to be someplace that they were showing a movie. So the movies weren't as huge a part of my life as they may have been for you, but my goodness, was I a TV kid and a lot of other culture things that I really tried to get involved with. So as we go through this, it'll be kind of fun just to reminisce and see what I do remember and things that you might trigger another memory.
That's kind of sad on the movies because for me, looking at the list of the top 20 films of 1974, oh my goodness, you had some of the best films ever made in those. You had Mel Brooks at a double whammy that year with Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein.
And those I do have two memories from. I don't know that I ever got to see the movies until I was older. But, you know, as boys will be boys, 14-year-old boys running around, of course, we all like to brag around the saying, it's twoo from Blazing Saddles. Mm-hmm, and so, you know, we all like to think that that was what was going to happen to us when that opportunity arose. And of course... And then, of course, the other thing that I remember was in Young Frankenstein, the song, Put on a Ritz!
Oh, yeah.
So those were a couple of things that I really remember from those movies. Again, of course, as a 14-year-old, sitting around the fire scene from Blazing Saddles was pretty iconic, too, with the flatulence that was happening. 14-year-old boys enjoy flatulence jokes.
You know, 14-year-old boys and fart humor, you can't have anything better.
That's right.
Well, if you weren't a big one of movies, I'm guessing probably you didn't see my favorite movie of all time that year, which was The Godfather Part II.
Not that year. I didn't get to see it because obviously that would have been something that would have been way too beyond what my parents would allow me to see. I had kind of an experience like that. My dad worked for United Airlines, so we used to get to fly quite a bit when I was a kid. And we were flying to Hawaii when I was 14 years old on a family vacation. And it just happened that the movie that they were showing on the plane going to Hawaii was The Sting, which came out Christmas Day of 73. So it was still big in 74. And of course, I was as excited as could be because now I was going to get to watch a movie and there was only one choice available back then. So it's not like my mom could tell me I couldn't watch the movie. So I remember watching The Sting. And back in those times, just so you know, when they were going to show a movie on the airplane, they actually came in with the big rolls of film and they would open up the big projector in that was hanging from the middle of the plane and they would have to load the 35 millimeter film or whatever film size it was to show a movie. And we would watch the movie on the plane that way. So I got to see The Sting and none of my 14-year-old friends when I got home had ever seen that movie. So I got to be the pretty cool guy that got to see that movie when they hadn't seen it yet. And I can still remember we arrived in Hawaii and my mom being totally disgusted with the kinds of things that she saw on that movie and her telling me that that's why we don't allow you to go to movies.
That's a pretty tame movie by today's standards.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't even think they'd have to edit it to put it on primetime now. But anyway, it was... I remember getting to see The Sting. If I remember right, when I was 14, my mom finally broke down and let me go see a movie with my friend, but it was a nature movie. And I remember getting to go and see one of the nature movies at a theater. And to me, that was just the coolest thing in the world to actually get to go to a theater. Yeah, they were pretty strict on the movie side. So unfortunately, our conversation about movies, unless I've seen them as an adult later, I didn't have a lot of memories for those when I was 14. I was going to say, one of the things that I did think was funny is as I was looking through the list of the title of the top movies of 1974, and now as an adult looking back at it, I'm kind of thankful my mom didn't let me go to the movies because it was amazing how many of those movies were very much tied to the sexual revolution that was going on. You had movies like Emmanuel and a lot of those kinds of movies. If I remember right, Deep Throat came out in 1974. There was a lot of really, really what I would call raunchy movies that were happening in 1974. But it was just kind of a reflex of the culture, I think, that what was happening in the 70s. It was funny. This jumps ahead a couple of years. You know, Jimmy Carter got elected in 76 after Watergate, which happened in 74 when Richard Nixon resigned. And a few years ago, I was taking some of my students on a trip to Atlanta. And while they were doing some things, I had a chance to go to the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library there in Atlanta. And it's all set up like things were in 1976 when he walked into the White House. And It was such a throwback to me that I was almost in shock. The orange carpet that they had in there. And, you know, there was the time that they said that there was a malaise in our culture. And you could sense it when you were walking through the museum. It suddenly triggered my memories of what it was like to be a teenager at that time. So as we're doing this, do you remember that feeling we all kind of had when COVID first hit, that it just kind of felt like there was a darkness that had descended or a grayness that had descended over society? And that's a lot of my memory of the 70s. It was a very similar time where just a lot of really big culture things happening during that time, probably from, I don't know, 73, 74 up until 77 when I graduated high school or 78, something like that. It was just it was kind of a strange time. It was a gray time with orange hues from the shag carpet.
Yeah, you get the experience of being around at the end of the Vietnam War. And much like after there's any war, there's kind of a like you said, malaise is a good word for it. A nobody wants to tip scales to another one kind of thing. So
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
That, your relation to color and shag is the one that is something that triggers you back your past.
It really does. It really does. And my mom revolted against having orange carpet in our house, and instead we had green shag.
I was about ready to say your mom was no fun with no shag carpet, but then you said the green, so I guess
yeah. Oh yeah, no, we had the green instead of the orange.
Now, did you have plastic over the furniture too?
No, that was more of a 60s thing, I think. I remember my grandmother and my aunt had that over their couches, but my mom never did. Now, I know, you know, our family was, my dad was a deacon in our church, and we spent a lot of time at church. And in 1973, our church got new carpet, and the carpet on the stage was the orange shag carpet. And I have old wedding pictures from when I got married there in 79. And all of the wedding pictures have that orange shag carpet on there. So yeah,
all these great relations to shag. I mean, we had shag in one of our houses too. That stuff was a pain, you know, pain to vacuum up and all.
Oh, they sold rakes. You could go to the store and they had shag rakes for raking your shag carpet.
That's hilarious.
It was something else to have the shag carpet.
Okay, yeah. So we'll switch off of movies here shortly. I do want to bring up one more again. You weren't old enough at the time, but another favorite film of mine, which I only watched a few years ago for the first time, was The Conversation. Was that one I just watched a few years ago. I'm like, how have I not seen this yet?
Yeah, that's the first I've ever heard of it. I'm going to have to see if it's something. I didn't know anything about it. Oh, there it is.
You know, Gene Hackman at some of his best right there. It was directed Coppola, you know, so you had The Godfather and The Conversation in the same year.
Well, yeah, he was pretty big back then with those kinds of movies. So
you got a Scorsese one on there too, with Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Okay. Yeah. So if we're going to kind of breeze over movies, I assume even at 14, you didn't get a chance to see Benji or Herbie Rides Again.
No, again, they were out there, and obviously you have friends whose parents let them go to movies. So there was this thing of everybody got a new dog and his name was Benji. So there was a lot of that. But yeah, it wasn't me getting to go see those at all.
Okay, well, let's move on to TV. You said you were huge on the TV scene. What were some of your favorites?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, for me, the big one of 1974 that kind of ended up dominating life and then the spinoffs and things after that was the introduction of Happy Days in January of 1974, taking of the American Graffiti movie, which I hadn't been able to see, and suddenly bringing on Opie to get to be on a TV show with Happy Days. And of course, I grew up on the Andy Griffith Show, and Opie was always one of my favorite boyhood relatable kind of kids. So when all of a sudden he was doing Happy Days, that was just a really important show for us to get to watch. Was Happy Days. Yeah, I remember arguing with my friends over who was closer to Fonzie, which one of us was more cool. And I think it was my friend Rod that ended up winning, because he was the one that could walk into a room, put both thumbs up and say A and sound the most like Fonzie. But that was a big culture thing, was we would talk regularly about things that had happened on Happy Days. So we spent a lot of time talking about Happy Days. I remember there was a show called Emergency that happened back then, and it was a story about some paramedics in Los Angeles.
And yeah, I vaguely remember that one.
We used to watch that all the time. For some reason, it was just, there were a lot of cop shows in the 70s. And if you go back and you watch some of them, that kind of dark feeling that I was mentioning a few minutes ago, you can kind of sense it in some of the cop shows that they had. There was a grittiness to society at the time. So there was, what was it, Streets of San Francisco with Carl Malden. There was Mannix. There was, the sitcoms were always fun too. My dad, who was not a TV person, he had two shows that he would watch that I remember growing up. And that was All in the Family and MASH. He would watch those. And then probably my favorite TV show of all time, and I have the 4 caseload set or whatever it is, was the Carol Burnett Show. I loved the Carol Burnett Show. If I could ever have a chance to meet a celebrity, it would be Carol Burnett. Part of that is because my mom, who did not watch TV, she was very stern, let's put it that way. And it took a lot to get my mom to tell a joke or something like that. But every Saturday night, she would make sure that my sister and I got our baths, that we were all ready to go. It was all to get ready to go to church the next morning. But every Saturday night, we had to have it all done in time to be able to watch the Carol Burnett Show together. That was the only show I remember my mom watching regularly, was the Carol Burnett Show.
I definitely remember watching that with my family too. I was only, like I said, a few years old, but it lasted for a while. But yeah, yes. I agree. Carol Burnett was probably one of the funniest, comics out there. And she's just, she goes down in history as being that hilarious character in the time of only having really Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett, if you think about female comedians of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it was always fun when Lucille Ball went on the Carol Burnett Show. That's some classic television. If you ever want to see something that's just hilarious, is watching Lucy and Carol together on her show doing things. But again, because I was so many things I loved on TV, probably more of them from the 60s, but then to see people from them later in the 70s was good, or was part of what connected me. I used to love to watch McHale's Navy. And of course, on McHale's Navy was Tim Conway. So then when Tim Conway became a regular on the Carol Burnett Show, I love that even more because I was such a fan of Tim Conway. And today I go, when I'm scrolling through on TikTok or something and the clips from the old Carol Burnett Show and how they would make each other crack up and things like that, they're the ones that I stop on when I'm spinning through because every one of them just has different memories for me. So the Carol Burnett Show was an important show. Different shows like Sanford and Son, who Red Fox grabbing his chest, Elizabeth, that's a big one. And seeing those kinds of things. And
Coming to see you easy.
Yeah. And his cut downs of people that he would do, they're just, I enjoyed watching Sanford and Son. Of course, Good Times came out back then with Jimmy J.J. Walker and Dynamite. And so that was always cool in my circle of friends. It was either A or Dynamite. those were the things that we used to try to show how cool we were because we had those kinds of things. There was a short-lived TV show, a cop show called SWAT, which now everybody knows what a SWAT team is, but back then that was a new thing that nobody knew what special weapons and tactic were. It was a TV show that came out for a little while that was pretty cool. I had a boyhood crush on Angie Dickinson on Policewoman. Oh, yeah. That was cool. My little sister always loved to watch Little House on the Prairie, but that was just, that was too tame for someone as cool as I was. So we didn't really, but we would fight over our one TV and get out of the chair remote control, as in stand up and go change the channel that we had to do. So we would fight over whether or not we were going to watch Little House on the Prairie or something else.
Interesting that Little House on the Prairie and the Waltons are kind of like similar, they're the same time frame. So you get these old house families, and John Boy and.
Yeah. As a kid, I enjoyed the Waltons, and it's probably just because their family had boys my age. So I could relate to it, as opposed to Little House that was just a bunch of girls running around. Lisa Gilbert never did it for me. So I just, I was not a big Little House fan, but I enjoyed the Waltons. Okay.
Actually, looking down this list, at 14 years old, you didn't have too many characters that were around your age, kids in general, aside from Little House and the Waltons. Cause I'm looking around and I'm like, no, older.
Oh yeah, it was a lot of medical shows, cop shows, and then some sitcoms. But back then too, we didn't have the choices either. We had the three networks. That's what you watched in primetime. Didn't have nearly the choices that we have today. I'm old enough that I remember to get some of the different channels. You had to stand up and move the rabbit ears around on the TV to get a better picture. You know, it's funny. It was probably about 1973 or 74. I don't remember that we got our first color TV. I had remembered as a little kid watching The Wonderful World of Disney coming up and the NBC Peacock, and it would come up and say in living color. And as a little kid, I'd think, great, we get to see this in color. And of course, it was black and white because we didn't have a color TV. To me, when we got our first color TV, that was pretty revolutionary. I think it was some really heavy 19-inch TV that we had, but that's what we would sit around and watch the movies.
Was it on top of a TV tray?
Yeah, it was, actually.
not really a TV tray, but my dad bought the stand for us to set it on. And I can still remember coming home, and I remember when we turned on the TV, the first thing that happened to be on when the TV came on, and I was just fascinated that we had a color TV, was The Great Waldo Pepper. And watching that movie on TV in color, thinking, wow, this is so cool. We now have a color TV. So I got, that was fun. But yeah, TV was it was kind of my peephole into paradise, if you want to, or something. That I really spent a lot of time on TV. Come home from school, come in and sit down and watch the old reruns of Gilligan's Island, McHale's Navy, those things that were on in the afternoons. Back then, it used to be from 3:30 to 5 o'clock was geared towards kids coming home from school to watch TV. So that's when they would show things like that. And then, of course, the news would come on at 5 o'clock and we would all lose interest.
Well, I still remember coming home from school and actually watching soap operas. I think General Hospital was actually what I would watch when I was in school sometimes.
No, those had all happened. I grew up in the Rocky Mountain time zone. So by the time we got home from school, the soap operas were over and we could watch the other shows. And then, of course, we were still in the era of Saturday morning cartoons. And even as a 14-year-old, I can remember wanting to watch those Saturday morning cartoons when you get up and get to have your bowl of Count Chocula cereal and watch the morning cartoons. And you know, that was another thing that was, I think it was in the 74, was Frankenberry and Count Chocula came out.
Yeah, just those two, you know, Boo Berries or anything like that?
Oh, no, didn't have any of those. It was Frankenberry and Count Chocula, and the commercials were arguments about between the two of them, which was better, chocolate or the berries. And, of course, that carried over to our friend conversations of which one did we prefer, Count Chocula or Frankenberry. And I was always a Count Chocula fan, which was really just chocolate Rice Krispies. Maybe if I remember right, it had some marshmallows in it.
But chocolate marshmallows and chocolate Rice Krispies. Yep. And I'm with you there, because it always made the milk. It's like Rice Krispies. It made the milk chocolate milk at the end, so it's like a double boost. Yeah, I definitely remember Saturday morning cartoons. You know, those were the greatest. You know, they don't have that kind of stuff anymore, obviously, because you can just stream whatever you want.
Exactly. And we've become much more, the demographics now, they can target different channels for different demographics, which, you know, as you think about it as a society, that maybe has led to some of the division we have as a society today, is that back then we had a commonality. If you wanted to, everybody watched All in the Family, or everybody watched The Jeffersons or MASH or whatever it was, because we didn't have other things to watch. So it united us. And now with 250 different channels that you can watch, that's been one of the things that's kind of surprised me as a teacher over the last 18 years in the classroom. Is back then we used to say, hey, did you guys watch Survivor or whatever? Mm-hmm. And the kids related to it. And now we talk to the kids and they don't watch TV. They're doing everything on YouTube or TikTok or something. And that part of our culture, that unity that we had as a culture, is kind of gone.
So. Well, and we compete with that too, because now everything is a 1 minute clip here, a 1 minute clip there. And anything longer than that, they start losing attention spans. And so, it's difficult to fight that. But I agree 100%. Like when Survivor first came on in 2000, it was like everybody was talking about it. I felt instantly in love with that show. You know, everybody's talking about it. And same thing with MASH and all that, especially when they eventually get to the season finale or the series finale. You know, everybody watched it. It was more viewed than the Super Bowl, I think, that year.
It was. It just, it's crazy. The just the way I hadn't really thought about it until just now as we're talking about it, but the unity that we had as a society based upon the entertainment that was coming through our TVs. Maybe that was a good thing that we had back then. Wasn't always great TV, but it was probably better for our society than what we have today.
I could agree with that. Yeah. I see one here that's interesting to me is that I put on popular television miniseries as well, and they got one called The Missiles of October. You probably didn't watch it at 14, but it's one about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which I just taught in class last week. So,
oh, really? Yeah, I don't remember watching that one. There was a movie, I forget when it came out. It might not have been till the 80s, but it was about a nuclear malfunction that wiped out society. And I can remember just a picture of a little kid sitting on the beach with the red mushroom cloud off in the distance over the water. And it was a pretty scary thing about what was going to happen with some nuclear war.
Well, you guys were in the middle of the Cold War still. I mean, that's one of the reasons for the everything being so.
Yeah, we didn't know what was going to happen. It was, you know, our president had resigned. And even again, as a kid, I wasn't all into the politics or anything like that, but you just knew that there was an unraveling that was taking place. And it was kind of tough being a kid back then in some ways.
Okay. Well, I think we've kind of finished up with TV, unless you got something else that you remembered or you thought about that we didn't cover yet.
No, I think that's good.
So moving on then, how about you and music? Were you, you weren't big in movies. You did like your TV. How about music?
Well, I enjoyed listening to music. Most of it had to be listened to when my parents were not around. I can remember my dad yelling at me to shut off that noise if anything came up that was sounding at all like rock and roll. But no, I liked the music. Again, the music became one of those ways that I could feel like I was culturally connected. Mm-hmm. To my friends and having things to talk about because I couldn't see movies. I could at least connect to them through music. So that was fun. Probably there's a few songs that I really liked from that. I love Jim Stafford's Spiders and Snake. That came out in 74 and that was just a fun song. You know, I don't like spiders and snakes, but that ain't what it takes to love me. And again, probably because of the awkwardness of a boy in that song, talked about an awkward boy trying to make a relationship with a girl. So that was something I could relate to a little bit. Another song that came out back then that had a big influence on what was happening in culture was the fun song, The Streak.
I was going to bring that up. Thank you. Ray Stevens, man, he was great.
Yeah, and Ray Stevens was so fun with the different things he did. I loved, when the day the squirrel came to church in the first self-righteous church. But The Streak, Gladys, you get your clothes on. And, those things.
That's why they call him The Streak.
It was, and of course, streaking was a big thing back then in culture. That's why he did the song, because there just seemed to all of a sudden be this thing of people wanting to take off their clothes and run through the stadiums or that kind of stuff. So streaking was a big deal. We had this is kind of a scary thing to even admit, but one time I remember staying at a friend's house and there were three or four of us that were spending the night. And in the middle of the night, we were deciding that we were going to challenge somebody that they had to streak. They had to run down the street naked. Of course, it was midnight and there was nobody on the street to see anything. But it was like, who's going to be the one that's going to actually streak at midnight down the street on 71st Place? And
that's when you want to take truth, not dare.
Yeah, and it wasn't me. I was never brave enough to do it. I may have done it, but left my underwear on. I don't know. But
you're only saying this because we're being recorded right now.
That's right. I'm not going to admit to anything, but I could sure tell on some of my friends that probably did it. So that was kind of a fun thing with the music back then. There were a lot of social songs expressing the signs of the time, I think. There was the song by Paul Anka, Having My Baby. And I actually was just listening to that the other day, and I didn't realize how culturally relevant it was. The whole thing was, having my baby, what a wonderful way of saying how much you love me. You know, that it was always just seemed kind of like a love song about a guy singing to his wife who was pregnant. But there's a line that he refers to in there that he said something about, you didn't have to keep it, wouldn't put you through it, could have swept it from your life, but you wouldn't do it. And it dawned on me that in 1973 was Roe v. Wade. So the song was there's a reference to what was going on, you know, so divisive in our society then, that whole issue of abortion that was going on when he recorded that song. So music, I think, in some ways was reflecting what was going on in society. We also started seeing some of the early disco songs where there was kind of a crossover from Motown to disco. We started seeing some things like that. Disco, you know, really hit its peak in probably 76, 77. But there were inklings of some of that dance beat that was starting to come out. You know, we had Kool and the Gang doing Jungle Boogie and Boogie Down with, you know, Boogie Fever.
Everybody's boogieing.
Yeah, there was a lot of boogie stuff going on back then. And, you know, there, like I say, the Motown, the OJs, you know, were talking, singing, Diana Ross. There was a lot of Motown into the top 40 songs all the time. But at the same time, you still had some of the, I guess, folk song kind of stuff. I'm thinking of Carly Simon and James Taylor singing Mockingbird. And then
John Denver.
Yeah, there was John Denver out there at that time. So that was fun. And then it was funny, the other day, there was the song Smoking in the Boys Room that was a big hit in 74. And I thought about it when I walked into our bathroom at the school the other day, and there were like 20 boys standing around in the bathroom. And of course, nobody was smoking, but it suddenly dawned on me that still the same thing of guys going, hanging out in the bathroom between
cell phone and in the boys' room.
Yeah. Now it's my vaping in the boys' room or something like that. But anyway, but I thought of that song the other day, you know, about smoking in the boys' room when I walked in and everybody was in there. So
I guess at our school, it's smoking in the boys' room and sitting on the floor in the women's room.
Is that what they're doing in there? I don't know.
the announcement came on several weeks back and says, ladies, don't sit on the bathroom floor.
Oh, I'll tell you, there was a song, Charlie Rich had a song, Hey, Did You Happen to See the Most Beautiful Girl in the World? Mm-hmm. And I remember that I had a 14-year-old romance, you know, the two-week-long 14-year-old romance. When we broke up, that song just meant so much to me because, you know, in my mind, she was the most beautiful girl in the world. And was she crying because we weren't together anymore? So, yeah, and every time I hear that, I reflect back. And honestly, if you were to ask me what that girl's name was, I couldn't tell you. I don't have any idea. Just remember thinking that she was the most beautiful girl in the world and we weren't together anymore.
Apparently, she did not become the most beautiful girl in the world. Also, you remember her for eternity.
Maybe. I sure thought at the time that she was, but... Anyway.
Probably my favorite song that I see listed in the top 100s, you know, billboards, was probably Redbone with Come and Get Your Love.
Yeah, that was a good song. You know, Come and Get Your Love. It was all right. I liked songs with a lot of harmony, or I like songs that, I don't know, maybe were less love song and more loose way to hooked on a feeling. I'm high on believing that you're in love with me and those kinds of things. But they were just a little, maybe more poppy songs and a little more fun, I guess, is what I liked.
Whenever we were at the Waffle House, I used their touch tunes, you know, and used my phone. And almost always I'll pick, Blue Suede song.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
That's funny. See, I'm just thinking of some of the other songs then. Bachman Turner Overdrive with one of my favorite groups back then. I even had the 8-track tape for Let It Ride. And, of course, my parents had gotten me an 8-track player that I had in my bedroom. And so I was collecting 8-tracks where I could. And BTO was one of my favorites, along with Bread. I remember I had my whole case of 8-track tapes that I had in a shoebox in the back of my car. my senior year of high school, because of course we had an 8-track player in the car too, in my 67 Mustang. And somebody broke into my car and they stole my 8-track tapes.
I have a 71 Beetle in the backyard that I've been meaning to work on with my son so that he can have a car when he, you know, gets to be driving age. And one of the things I thought would be fun to do in that is to be install an 8-track.
My first car, I might have gotten it when I was around 14, come to think of it, was a 59 Beetle. A friend of mine down the street was selling it. I bought it for $50. And it had a blown engine, and we pushed it down the street to my house up into our driveway. And I learned how to pull the engine out of the bottom of a Beetle, that air-cooled engine. And I pulled the engine out and had it sitting there beside the car. And some guy drove by and asked if it was for sale. And I ended up selling him my 59 Beetle for $150. I was pretty proud of myself for making $100 real quick.
Very nice. You're wheeling and dealing. I guess in this case, you're literally wheeling.
Exactly. Exactly. But I always tell people that my first car was a 59 Beetle, even though I never drove it. I had visions of putting shag carpet in the back seat.
And then being with your most beautiful girl in the world on the shag
there
carpet.
Was, there you go. You know, getting into the back seat of the Beetle.
that just makes my back hurt thinking about it.
I know this day and age, I mean, I'm not sure I could fit in the front seat of a Beetle now. And
so, oh, golly. I can't do that.
I can't get out of it once I fall into it.
So I think we got a good coverage of music there. You know, we got pretty much hit on many of the, you know, there was a lot of different kinds of genres going on. So
Really,
my big one was the comedy and novelty songs, because even though I was three, I grew up on these comedy songs, especially, you know, Ray Stevens was one of the biggest. So,
well, did I read something about you that you got to sing with Weird Al?
I did.
I love Weird Al.
We got tickets to his concert in September already and stuff. So,
yeah. Oh, that's cool. I didn't know he was still around. Some of the stuff that his parodies were just so fun. I loved his Michael Jackson, just eat it instead of beat it. And, you know, those things, he just, Weird Al was something special.
Yes, he still is. And he's still popular and still around. And now I just have to know what I listen to the Weird Al songs and go, what is the original? And then I go listen to the original. I'm assuming that video games probably weren't a large part, because in 74, it was still very, very early. So we only had a couple of video games that were out there. And then they were the most basic of basic.
We didn't have any at home. Now, I was in a Saturday morning bowling league, and I remember when the bowling alley got a Pong game.
Oh, yeah.
When they're at the bowling alley. And getting to play Pong was pretty fun to figure that out, that you could, and trying to learn how to put a spin on it, you know, that if you could time it just right, you could spin the wheel and hit that, and it would fake out the other guy and where the ball, where the little square was going. But yeah, that was our video game, was Pong.
I remember we had a home version of Pong. So that was my, I always tell the kids, that's the first like video game that I ever played, you know, Pong.
Well, you know, there's a great, but there's a scene where a guy's in a hospital bed and the heart monitor is going along on there. And all of a sudden the guy's sitting next to the guy in the hospital bed. It might've been Airplane. Yeah. Where they turn the heart monitor into a Pong game and they start playing Pong back and forth on that. So, but yeah, Pong was my video game, when I was 14.
It definitely sounds like Airplane or Zucker Brothers, whatever. Yeah,
it might have been. But now some of the culture stuff that happened in 74, I was thinking back on that. You know, that was the year that Evel Knievel was going to jump over the Snake River Canyon. There was all this talk about, you know, how he was going to do this. And we were all just so tuned in to find out if he was going to make it. And of course, we wouldn't get to see it live. We would have to wait a few weeks before the Wonderful World of Sports would come out on a Saturday, where they would then show what had happened. And I can remember, first of all, being very critical of the fact that they had talked about how he was going to jump over the Snake River Canyon on his motorcycle. And when I saw what it was actually a two-wheeled rocket, and it really was not a motorcycle. So that was kind of a, I thought, oh, what kind of a fraud is this? And then, of course, it didn't work when he went to jump and the parachute opened up and he ended up just dropping down into the Snake River Canyon. That was a big culture thing that happened in 74, was him trying to do that, to jump over the Snake River Canyon.
Good old Evel Knievel broke every bone in his body, practically.
Yep. Awful Knievel. And
so, I was like, later on down the road, the Super Dave Osborne, you know, parody of this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I remember the Super Dave Osborne stuff. You know, it's kind of back to the music again, but in 74, my parents took us on a trip to Germany. I had an uncle who had stayed over there and married a German woman and had a German family. And we went over there, and ABBA was just coming out in 1974. And my cousins, who could barely speak English, were starting to sing some of ABBA's songs. And all of a sudden, we connected that way. I thought, well, how do they know these songs? And we realized that we both knew the same songs because of ABBA. So that was kind of cool. I mean, I think they were from Sweden or Denmark or something. But in Germany, the kids knew the songs, and we were learning about them too. So that was kind of a neat memory that we had back then.
I like that.
Yeah. Muhammad Ali was big then. And
Sting Like a Bee.
Yeah. And that was the year of the Rumble in the Jungle with George Foreman and Muhammad Ali. And they were going to have this fight, and Ali ended up beating Foreman. And I think it was later that Foreman came back and beat Ali. And that's back when, again, back to uniting a culture, the heavyweight fights were big. And the entire society was all tuned in. It was big news. And maybe, again, because we just didn't have the diversions that we have now. Yeah.
Boxing in general goes back to the early 1900s on the radio. So it was a very popular thing that lasted for a long time. And like you said, I mean, the heavyweights during the 70s, those were huge. And I was a big Foreman fan. And I always tell the kids about how Foreman fought. But I mean, obviously, you know, all these big names and boxing was giant back then.
It really was. I can remember a couple of times listening to Muhammad Ali fights on the radio with my dad. And, you know, again, not that I was into the radio stuff of the 50s, but fights were still carried on the radio. Howard Cosell, a lot of times, would be the one doing the coverage of those. So got to, this is Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell.
Yep. Getting to do that. That was the year that Hank Aaron hit 715th and broke Babe Ruth's record, and how everybody thought that Babe Ruth's record would never be broken. And Hank Aaron did it. And it was a huge deal. I can remember seeing the front of Sports Illustrated magazine with, you know, 715 on it, where Hank Aaron did that. And it was also, there was a lot of racial transitions that were happening in the 70s.
Yeah, I was going to question that one.
Yeah. So for Hank Aaron to be an African-American man breaking Babe Ruth's record, I think it contributed to that cultural change that we started having, and showing more of an equity or an equality kind of thing. So again, I remember thinking what a big deal it was. And I can also remember watching games, waiting for it to happen, just building up. Is he going to do it tonight? Is he going to do it tonight? Kind of thing. And then when he finally did it, it was a big deal.
I wondered about that with the culture, because I mean, we're past the civil rights movement, kind of, sort of, but I know that racism doesn't just die off instantly afterwards. So I wondered how that would be killing off, you know, the Babe Ruth's record.
There was still a lot of it. And, you know, the civil rights movement was obviously in the 60s. There was still a lot of carryover over to it in 74, and people not really sure how are we going to live with this. So that's why you had shows like the Jefferson, where, you know, you show a upwardly mobile African-American family and the conflict that they had with an interracial marriage, their daughter marrying a white guy. You started seeing, there were a lot of the TV shows that we would see black families, and they were becoming normalized, which prior to that, you never saw a TV show with a black family, but they were becoming normalized, which was really good. But there was always still that racial tension that was being communicated in the TV shows.
I think All in the Family really encapsulated that with the Sammy Davis Jr. connection and things, because Archie Bunker was so racist, basically. And then he's like a black Jew. He's like, what the, he didn't know what to do.
Yeah. And, and of course the Jeffersons were a spinoff of All in the Family. The Jeffersons had been the Bunker's next door neighbor. And so whenever George Jefferson would come over to Archie's house, there was always the, because they were both equally racist. Let's put it that way. Archie would go after things about somebody being black, and George Jefferson would go after somebody about being white. And the old stereotypes were mocked back then. And I can remember, even in my family, my mom was a beautiful Christian woman, and I never saw any kind of racism with her. She was as giving and loving with everybody, but there were times, she grew up in Missouri and Iowa, and there were times that you would hear things come out in her, like her reasoning for telling us never put money in your mouth because a black person might have had it. Those kinds of things that she would say, and I don't think she ever realized how evil it was, because in her life there was never any of that kind of thing going on. When she was our church secretary, and our church was in a very racially diverse neighborhood, never once did I see my mom treating anyone any differently. But knowing that in her family that she grew up in, that kind of stuff was there. So when my sister married a guy that was, his mother was from Ecuador, there were some of my uncles that did not want to come to the wedding because they were afraid it was going to be an interracial marriage. So that kind of thing was still a real part of the culture in 74. We hadn't learned how to deal with it yet, with the results of the civil rights movement. So it was still there. There was still a lot of segregation that was happening and all of that, those kinds of things. So we've come a long way.
This is why I like this kind of stuff, because this is, we obviously got off of the pop culture a little bit, but actually, no, the pop culture tied right back in with all the TV shows and the way people were dealing with it. So it's interesting to see this, again, a 14-year-old at the time is going to recognize when racism is actually out there. So it's not like it's like I was too young to recognize this. It's just probably, like you said, a confusing time because of the big changes only less than 9 years earlier.
Yeah. I went in 10th grade when I went to school. All of a sudden, I was in a school that had, prior to that, I'd been in a school that had a lot of Hispanic, but not a lot of black kids. And when I, the high school, that changed. And I had a friend, he was an African-American friend, and he tried to convince me that when a black person got sunburned, they turned white.
Yep.
And and he was always trying to, it just was fascinating to me because I had never been around black people enough to know that that wasn't true. So there was this intermingling that started happening then that was, obviously it was great that it's happened. But when you're living through it, it was a crazy time.
Okay. It's all good insight and interesting there. Were you a comic book person at all?
Just when I'd go to the barbershop. I was never into the, like the Batman, the Superman book. I was into the Archies or Little Richie and those kinds of more, looking back at it now, maybe even more juvenile rather than the dark comics of Batman and all of those. So I don't remember back then the whole thing of Marvel and all of that, we didn't have nearly as much of a part of the culture as it is. DC and Marvel there, it was not, I don't remember it impacting culture much at all.
No, they were pretty, back in the 70s, the comic books were somewhat, and I hate to say this, generic in ways. They didn't have deep, long connections of plot and story that have gone on for years and stuff. You did have some big debuts of characters that are still incredibly popular today, and have made, TV shows and movies about them. So you had, in 74, you had Wolverine come out you know, in the Incredible Hulk. Punisher, you know, come out in 74. Iron Fist, which was made into a Netflix TV series, which was, You had Blade that was introduced shortly before. And some of these characters here are, you know, still either around or very popular still today.
Interesting. Yeah, we didn't, it wasn't part of my circle. So I just, you know, I remember you mentioned the Incredible Hulk. And of course, there was the TV show, The Incredible Hulk.
Oh, yeah.
That came out where Bill Bixby, you know, would rip open his shirt and turn into Lou Ferrigno. So there was that. But I don't think that, I don't remember if that was 74 or not, but probably was sometime after that because of the comic book.
There was a little thing about that is that in The Incredible Hulk, they said that Bruce was too feminine of a name. And so they changed him to, I think it was Bill Banner, or I can't remember actually his first name now, but it wasn't Bruce Banner in the TV show because they said Bruce was too feminine.
Well, you know how that goes.
So comic books weren't really a thing. That's okay there.
No, there was the other big thing that was happening then too was CB radios.
Oh yeah,
I wanted to mention that. I couldn't drive yet, obviously in 74, but I had older friends that had CB radios in their cars. So that was the trend that got going on the CBs. So we all had to come up with our handle that we had. My handle was Paper Pilot. Yeah, and the whole idea was because I had a short hobby of building balsa wood and paper airplanes, you know, that you'd stretch the paper over the balsa wood frame, and then you'd put the dope on, and it would shrink the paper and make it real tight and all of that. So that was my hobby at the time, so I called myself the Paper Pilot when I'd get on the CB radio. And of course, when I got my 67 Mustang, I had my 8-track player strapped underneath the dash, and I had my CB radio underneath the dash.
And, we got a Smokey on the,
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. What's your 20?
Those. Smokey and the Bandit, of course, made that like even more popular. But
And then C.W. McCall's song Convoy. Yeah, that was kind of a novelty song, but it was all about the CB radios. You know, we got a convoy, and so that was a big song back then. And the CB radios, part of it, you know, fashion. I fight with my dad over wanting to have some bell-bottom pants. He thought that was just, boys don't wear bell-bottom pants. And we had a big argument. I can still remember standing in the utility room having a fight with my dad about it. And then I'm going to get some jeans, and she bought some flare. And oh boy, that was a big move, because I then had some jeans with flare.
I just can't picture, you know, you in bell bottoms and in a shirt with, you know, bling on it and stuff, you know.
I'm gonna have to find the picture and show you. I was pretty cool, man. I had my baby blue leisure suit with the big collar nylon shirt with the big collars, and my original puka shell necklace that I got on that trip to Hawaii where I saw the sting, buying a puka shell necklace so that I could look so cool walking around with my photo gray glasses and my long hair with the sideburns coming way down as mutton chops. And I was pretty cool back then.
I think that's going to be for your retirement party here.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
So comic books, we kind of sort of covered since there weren't too many of them there. Toys, you had one huge one that year, but I would guess you probably didn't play it since it wasn't super popular yet. Dungeons and Dragons, the first edition of Dungeons and Dragons.
No, I never did. That was back in the day when Dungeons and Dragons were of the devil.
Yep.
And there were all kinds of things in the church about parents, do not let your kids play Dungeons and Dragons or they will become demon possessed.
Yep. And movie for that one with Tom Hanks called Mazes and Monsters, where they showed how evil Dungeons and Dragons was.
Exactly. So no. We stayed far, far away from Dungeons, Dragons, and Ouija boards. those were, if mom ever thought I was going to somebody's house that had any of that stuff in their house, that just wasn't going to happen. We didn't do that. But
a loaded gun.
Yeah. But I think Nerf balls came out about then, and those were acceptable. We played with Nerf balls and Nerf footballs, and that was kind of cool. You know, at 14, you're not playing with as many toys, I don't think.
No. Funny enough, on the Nerf, going back to Nerf real quick, is that back last week I did the 2009 one, and he actually talked about Nerf as well, because he didn't do many toys either. But he talked about Nerf as well, and I said, that's one of those ones that has lived through time, and obviously right here is the proof of the pudding right there, and, you know, being 74.
Yeah. I think that's about when they came out, but it was pretty cool to have those foam balls to be able to throw at each other and that kind of stuff. That was kind of fun. You know, the family played card games a lot, not with real playing cards, though, because real playing cards were of the devil. But we could could play games like Rook, you know, which we used to always say that, because the game of Rook is exactly like the game of, what is it, Rummy or something like that. But you played with different cards. So we used to always call Rook Pentecostal poker, because it was acceptable, but playing with real cards was not. But games like Pit came out then. Yeah, me too. I have a memory of playing Pit. My mom was playing with us, and she would really get into the game. And I was sitting next to her, and she yelled, "The exchange is open," and swung her arm to start trading, and knocked her cup of hot coffee right into my lap. so I can remember Pit because of the pit that it left in my leg from playing the game with her. But yeah, we played Pit. We played Rook. I had several friends that they were playing Risk, but I never had the patience to try.
I didn't realize that game came out that early.
Yeah, it was around then, but I never had the patience. I didn't want to overcome the world, so I didn't really play that with them too much. But that came out about that time, I think. But
for games, I play the game of Rook every day these days. Of course, that's trying to win arguments with my teenager.
His name. Oh, it is. Okay. Interesting. But yeah, I mean, I had, by the time in 74, I was starting to want things like electronic stuff. So might have been a little earlier than 74, but I remember my mom got me for Christmas the orange Panasonic round transistor radio that came on a chain that you could hang it. So I had that round radio that I had sitting next to my bed for a lot. Getting a TV for your bedroom was a big thing. If you could ever
get a TV for the bedroom. Yeah.
You know, and of course the TVs then, the movie Spaceballs, the helmet of the guy, the big white helmet, that one, they had TVs that looked like that. So that was a big deal to get a TV that had that kind of spacey shape to it. And of course they were like a 9-inch screen. Not even as big as our tablets are, and they weighed about 40 pounds. That was a pretty cool thing to get a TV for your room. Like I say, I had the 8-track player. I had a turntable in my room back then that I could listen to music. And that was, but again, I had to be really careful what kind of music that I had. Some of it I kept hidden so that if my dad ever came into my room, he wouldn't know I had that kind of evil music in my house.
I think I remember something about that with when I was taking one of my classes in college years ago, and talked about you had like the pure happy, you know, good music on top of the, you know, on your shelf, and then you had Little Richard hiding underneath your cushions and stuff.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because I'd try to watch American Bandstand on Saturdays, and my dad would hear it, and he'd say, "Turn off that loud hippie freak music that you got playing in there." And
that's why he wouldn't get you bell bottoms.
That's right, because he was afraid I was going to turn into some hippie freak. And yeah,
okay,
that was it.
So let's see, moving on. Then you had a bunch of, I mean, the commercials that came out this year are still stuck in my brain today. A lot of them are, at least. Donald's had their iconic one, you know, "You Deserve a Break Today." I think that song is permanently etched in my brain.
Yeah, so get up and get away. Is that also when they came out with what was, now all of a sudden I'm going to draw a blank on it, but the contents of the Big Mac that you, that all became the big.
Yeah, two all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun.
And it's still stuck into my head. But that was a big, that was a big thing to see who could see that the fastest. And again, I don't remember if that was 74 or not, but that was a big deal.
Probably close to there, if anything else.
I think actually the quarter pounder came out in 74.
And yeah.
So that was a different thing, was to all that's, you know, it's funny because prior to that, hamburgers were always a thin patty that when you'd buy them, you know, when I go to Sonic or something today and I get one of their just regular hamburgers, that's kind of the way hamburgers were back then. They were all that thin patty on a bigger bun. And all of a sudden McDonald's came out with the quarter pounder, and the thought of eating a quarter pound of meat on a sandwich was just revolutionary.
Huh.
to get that much meat on a sandwich. And of course, now they got the double quarter pounders, all mm-hmm. of those kinds of things. I grew out on those, not
quarter
up.
Pounds.
Yeah, I grew out on those, not up.
And, yeah. I worked at McDonald's, so I think I definitely grew out as well.
Yeah, I worked at McDonald's when I was 16. When I was 14, I got my first job at a little drive-in restaurant in our town called Chuckwagon. They put me on the fryers. You know, today a 14-year-old wouldn't be allowed to work on the fryers.
You learn life lessons really fast.
You do. You really do. You learn you don't throw water into them. But yeah, I worked the fryers at Chuckwagon when I was 14.
They had this time, they had Life cereals, the Hey Mikey. And this one is important for me because my mom says that I looked like Mikey when I was that age. And so people would always stop her and say, is that Mikey?
That one never made sense to me because they would cereal. What's this? Some cereal is supposed to be good for you. I don't want it. No, I don't want it. Let's get Mikey. He hates everything. And it's like, if he hates everything, why are you giving it to Mikey? I never understood that. But of course, then Mikey would eat it and he'd go, hey, he likes it. And of course, then they'd start eating it. But it never made sense to me. If Mikey hates everything, what makes you think he's going to like this? I just never quite understood that line.
Maybe it was just early bullying.
Maybe we're going to force this kid to eat something we don't want to eat. Maybe that's what it was. Yeah, commercials were a fun thing. What else you got on the commercials? I
got at least one more to bring up here. Was the Alka-Seltzer. I can't believe I ate the whole thing.
Yeah. Yep, that one. And of course, that one permeated culture too, because, you know, you'd eat a big meal or something and you'd push back to the table and I can't believe I ate the whole thing. That was an important part of our culture back then to do that.
You got all the right. You got all the fun slang. You know, this is stuff I still say every once in a while.
Which ones? Like cool.
Give me some of the ones you had. You had the A and the dynamite.
And dynamite and boogie. We're gonna boogie out of here. There were things like you'd tell somebody, you know, bite the wall.
Bite the wall. What was bite the wall? Like just turn around and walk away.
Yeah, it was like kind of like the, you know, how the whole thing, the talk to the hand kind of stuff was bite the wall. And it was that's one I remember. And then, of course, we changed it to be really cool. We called it masticate the supporting structures of this building.
You're advanced for your age.
Yeah, I really was. Of course, we still said peace and peace out. I remember the boogie things, you know, where the pictures of the guy with the great big leg sticking out and the big foot and, you know, boogie down kind of thing was a picture that was then.
Can you dig it?
Yeah, can you dig it was one. I think groovy was still around. But
that's my go-to.
Yeah, that's groovy.
Man, bummer.
Bummer. What a bummer.
That was what a bummer, dude.
Yeah, that was one. So yeah, you're bringing back those memories for me now. I'm glad you've done the research. So
that's what I say to my future guests is that I give you a lot of this stuff just to kind of, you know, lead us down the right path. So, you know,
yeah, it triggers things. It triggers the memories.
It's pretty far out.
Yeah. Far out, man. What a bummer.
Or JJ Walker, he said Jive Turkey.
Oh yeah. And it might have been a little bit before that, but we also had the What You Talking About, Willis kind of thing.
That's early 80s.
Was that early 80s? Okay.
I want to say early 80s, but maybe I might be wrong.
Oh, there was one that came from the Laverne and Shirley show.
Haas and Pfeffer Incorporated.
Well, yeah, there was that. But I think it was maybe just the way Lenny and Squiggy would always come in the house. They go, hello. And mm-hmm. that kind of became a thing of to try to mock them when you came into the house. You'd say, hello. to be like Lenny and Squiggy.
Get you on the flip side.
Yeah, maybe some. That one wasn't I don't remember in my circles anyway that was a big, big one. Obviously, I've heard it since then and all that kind of stuff, but just not sure it was a big one for me. But yeah, I think that was most of it.
Okay, well then let's move on to some of the fads. You've already talked about CB radios and stuff, but we'll just do a couple of these fads here. Did you have a pet rock?
I did not. I remember seeing them and thinking how stupid they were. but yeah, pet rocks, you know, people were giving them for birthday presents and Christmas presents. I can remember walking into the department stores and having whole displays of cardboard box that looked like a dog kennel with a rock in it. And it was a pet rock. And I always thought, that is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life.
If you had used it in your marketing classes, you could say, look how idiotic this is, but how many probably millions of dollars it made for the guy that created it.
Oh, from as a marketing teacher now, I see it and I'm just thinking, my goodness, that's fantastic that somebody was able to make money off of that.
Hula hoops and pet rocks.
Yep. Great movie about hula hoops. I don't know if you've ever seen the Hudsucker Proxy.
Oh, yeah.
I've used that when I'm teaching economics. It's a fantastic movie that shows market forces at play and things like that, all while being fun. So
you don't show them the Wolf of Wall Street in your class?
You know, I was going to show them the edited version and it ended up just being credits. And so
another one that was out then was platform shoes, which I'm assuming you didn't have since you didn't have bell.
Oh no, I gotta tell you, do we have time for a platform shoe story,
dude? We have time for anything. I can edit or cut in and out whatever we need to.
So this was probably more like 75 than 74 because I knew I wasn't driving yet, but we had a girl living with us, kind of like a foster sister situation. And I had the coolest platform shoes. They were black with complete white rubber soles. They were the coolest platform shoes you've ever seen. Well, one summer evening, we were in downtown Denver with Renee and I, and we were in downtown Denver. And we got into an argument of what we were going to listen to on the radio. She was driving and I was the passenger and we were arguing. And I finally said, forget it. I'm getting out of the car. You won't let me listen to what I want to listen to. And I jumped out of the car at the next stoplight. And again, keep in mind, this is the 70s and I'm on East Colfax in downtown Denver. Ooh. And I jumped out of the car and started walking home. Now, home was probably 7 or 8 miles from where I was. And it's about 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And I just took off walking down East Colfax. I knew I had to get to Colorado Boulevard, then head north on Colorado Boulevard, and I would eventually get to my house. So I was mad and started walking. Renee proceeded to drive around the block and come back to look for me, and she couldn't find me. So she kept driving around and she couldn't find me walking down the street on East Colfax. And again, no cell phones back then when we have all this stuff. So I got out to Colorado Boulevard and started heading north. And I got up into the area by what is City Park. And of course, I'm walking along Colorado Boulevard and a guy steps out from behind the building. I think he was like 12'7". I remember being scared to death. And he walked out from behind the building and told me that I was the wrong color to be in his neighborhood. And what was I doing there at 10 o'clock at night walking down his street?
Ooh.
I immediately, who I've always been pretty good with, you know, being able to talk myself out of a situation. And I started talking to him and sharing with him that I had gotten in a fight with my sister and I was just trying to walk home and all of that. And finally he tells me, he says, well, you know, you're going to have to pay to get through my neighborhood. And I'm thinking, what am I going to do? I have nothing to pay with. I don't know anything. And we had actually been at a church conference in downtown Denver. And you know how you pick up trinkets and things like that from the different exhibits and everything at the conference. And I had some of those in my pocket. But we're walking along and he looks at me, he goes, well, those are some pretty nice shoes. Give me your shoes. And he wanted my platform shoes. I started talking. I did not want to give him my shoes. Now, as an adult, now I look back at it and I think I'm taking off the shoes, giving them to him and moving on. But I started negotiating about how the shoes weren't going to fit him. I could see that because he was 12 foot six and I was 3 feet tall, that those shoes were not going to fit him. Started telling me about his little brother could wear them or something. Finally, I remembered that I had in my pocket an address book and a pen that I had gotten from this conference. And I started talking to him and told him I thought he looked like a really handsome guy that probably had a lot of girls he had to keep track of. And I pulled out this address book and pen and asked him if that would work to get me through his neighborhood. It worked. He let me go. I got to the next gas station and didn't have any money. So I made a quick collect call to my mom and dad to tell them where I was, because by now I am terrified. Come to find out, they had all been at home praying that I was safe. Renee had gotten home and told them the story and they didn't know where I was. Dad came and got me and I got in all kinds of trouble, but I still had my platform shoes.
And now you have the ability to choose whatever song goes on the radio.
Exactly. But that's my platform shoe memories, or my black and white platform shoes that almost got me killed.
Platform shoes almost lead to the demise of Bruce.
That's right.
Oh, golly.
So, yeah.
Okay. The only other thing I showed for trends or the fads at the time were, well, there's more, but mood rings.
Oh, yeah. Mood rings were a cool deal. My biggest memory I have about mood rings is one of my best friends, his mom and dad were going through a divorce and his mom wore a mood ring all the time. And the entire time that she was going through the divorce, her mood ring was black. And she would come and she would talk to me and I would see her and she would say, no, you can see I'm still so sad. And she would show me her ring. And it was always black because of her being so distraught from going through this divorce. So, but then she met somebody and she showed me that the ring had changed color.
Neon pink.
Something. I don't remember, but it wasn't black anymore. And, but yeah, mood rings. Those were things that I might've had a mood ring. They had them for men and they had them for women. And I may have had a mood ring for a little while, but yeah, those were, that was kind of a cool trend that we had back then.
Okay, so I got done with that category there. Let's go ahead and see what kind of food you had back then, because you had some really fun ones in 1974 that are still around today and have grown significantly since then.
Sure.
But do you have any favorite foods or anything like that from this time frame that you remember, you know, fondly? Well,
Pop Rocks were kind of a cool thing. Dump those into somebody's mouth and then listening to them pop and crackle.
That was our high school graduation experiment there. Our laugh thing was that during graduation, when it got to a certain point, all the seniors were supposed to put Pop Rocks in their mouth. And so, yeah, sure enough, it was like a big old sizzle.
Yeah. I remember Pop Rocks. I never liked them. They were just very uncomfortable to me. I had other friends that they just thought they were the greatest thing to put the Pop Rocks in their mouth, that kind of thing. So yeah, Pop Rocks were big. I remember we talked about the Quarter Pounder already and how that came out. And I was a huge McDonald's fan my whole life, even as a little kid. I always thought McDonald's was something special. So the Quarter Pounder was a big deal.
Yeah, we got it now where the Quarter Pounders are all not frozen meat, but I've tried the difference and it's about the same as they were before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you and I both worked at McDonald's and, you know, I remember working the grill with the Quarter Pounders and then the 10-to-1 meat that we had for the hamburgers and Big Macs and that kind of thing. So McDonald's was always the kind of the go-to for us. If we didn't have one, we were in a suburb of Denver, but it was a very commercial suburb where I grew up. So we didn't have a lot of retail. If we go across town to Westminster or Thornton, that would be where there was a McDonald's, and it was a big deal to get to go to McDonald's. And so
did you have, when you were at McDonald's, did you have your own Frankenstein versions of whatever burgers you were making for yourself?
No, actually where that was, where if you wanted to go do your own Frankenstein burger, you had to go to Burger King, you know, because Burger King was hold the pickle, hold the lettuce, special orders, don't upset us. All we ask is that you let us serve it your way. Yeah. And their whole thing was that Burger King, it was okay to change the order and make it special. McDonald's, you weren't allowed.
Well, but when we were, but when we were employed there, at least when I worked at McDonald's in 90, is that it, before we'd go and put our order in the front and things, we'd, you know, Frankenstein our own burgers in the back. So I remember with a quarter pounder, I would do, I'd put mayonnaise on mine with the ketchup and stuff, and use, you know, of course, the real onions and all that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't remember really doing that a lot. I remember, you know, my days at McDonald's would have been in 76. And I can remember, you know, mixing up the special sauce. It was two cans that you had to mix together for the Big Mac sauce. Mixing those cans and not being allowed to tell anybody what was in the Thousand Island dressing with relish.
You broke your NDA.
Oh no, it's probably expired since then.
Yeah, we had it where they were in tubes, so we didn't have any mixing at that. We just basically squirted it out of a tube.
Yeah, we had to put it into, and you had the guns that you'd put it into for squirting it on the stuff.
Yep.
And doing it that way. But as far as other foods, let's see, there was TV dinners were changing. I think they were, is that probably about when Hungry Man or those kinds of bigger TV dinners started coming out.
Oh, and yeah, the Hungry Man, which had the nice little apple cobbler or peach cobbler or brownie, you know, those kinds of things. Oh, yeah.
And as a 14-year-old boy, that was just a great way to get to eat. And there was enough food in one then that, you know, you felt like you were eating more.
And we did. I don't know if you did, but we also had the TV trays and stuff. So, you know, we would eat in front of the TV.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had the TV trays, you know, the little display over in the corner that they all hung on, and you go over and get one, set it all up. So, yeah, we had the TV trays and would watch and eat a TV dinner on the TV tray, watching TV on our 19-inch new color TV. So we had that. I just think a lot of prepared foods started coming out in 74. It was probably just a difference in the technology that they had for, you know, how to store them and things like that. So Tang, I remember Tang was kind of was maybe a little bit earlier when it first came out, but it was something that was, you'd still drink it once in a while. It was, I compare the way Tang was back then to kind of the way Gatorade is today. You know, we would do Tang instead of Gatorade. Well, we didn't have Gatorade, but it was kind of that type of thing. You'd mix it up, and it was a special time when we got to drink Tang.
You talk about prepared goods, you know, goods that were longer shelf life. Some of the bigger ones here, a couple of them were Hamburger Helper and the Bisquick Shake and Pour pancake mix.
Yeah, we never had the Bisquick Shake and Pour because my mom always, you know, would make pancakes from scratch kind of thing. But the
Hamburger Helper,
that was kind of a big deal. My mom really got into the Hamburger Helper when I was growing up. She thought that was just pretty slick that she could just brown some hamburger and throw that stuff in and we'd have dinner.
So, I tried some recently just to see if it was a memory thing or whatever, or if it's changed at all. I could feel my arteries clogging with the salt that was in the thing.
Oh, I know. It was just, looking back at it now, it's like, how did we live? But compared to what's in our food today, it probably wasn't nearly as bad as we think it was.
True.
But yeah, that was... You know, I remember, too, a lot of attempts at ethnic food. So I remember my mom would buy a can of Le Choy chow mein.
Oh, yeah.
And then she would put it over the crunchy chow mein noodles. Suddenly we were eating Chinese food.
Yep. So, I stole the recipe somewhere in one of my old cookbooks from my mom. That you know, she typed up all of her old recipes. And that's one of them, that they're with the chow mein, you know. It's still good. You know, it's just like a beef and chow mein casserole, but it's still good.
Well, I don't know what was in the stuff that she used to make, but it was, I just remember her opening up in a can of the Le Choy chow mein and then opening up those brown noodles, those hard, crispy noodles, and putting it over that. That good was stuff. A meal that we have. Yeah. Yeah.
We're world travelers. You know, we are well onto our way of understanding how the world is.
Oh, and we have such refined palates. Oh, from golly. That kind of thing.
Two of the others there, the snack foods that I saw, were Charms Blow Pops, which I remember people would sell those things in high school for like a 50 cents or a dollar per blow pop and make tons of money. And Charms Blow Pops with bubble gum.
Used to have those, and that was kind of a cool deal to get those.
The other horrible one, which was like almost as bad as Juicy Fruit, was the Fruit Stripe gum. Had great flavor for about 3 seconds.
Yipe Stripes, Beech Nut Gum, or Fruit Stripe Gum. Yeah, I remember those. That was cool.
The zebra.
Yeah.
That stuff, man, like I said, you'd lose the flavor in like 3 seconds. But this is great. Okay, I'm done.
Yep, I'm throwing it out now. It's bad.
We're sticking it to the bottom of a desk. So. Kids still do that today. Drives me insane.
Oh, I know. I know it.
I don't know. Is there anything else to think of in the course of our journey here through 1974 that we have forgotten that really kind of was a key part of your life as a 14-year-old? I mean, we've covered a lot of material today. So
can't think of anything else. It's been fun.
Yeah. I even though I was only three in 1974, really, I remember a ton of these things, you know, just even being three, you know, and growing up. And my family wasn't incredibly well off early on in my life. You know, we lived, you know, a modest lifestyle and things. So we had some of these things, but being a three-year-old at this time, it's interesting to see your points of view because you were obviously more mature. You didn't have the experiences necessarily that I had. So this is why I do this podcast, because I want to see, you know, what was the real thing? How was it being a teenager in 74? So I've got some really great insight from you on this.
Well, good. It's been fun getting to do this. And I'm looking forward to when you get it all finished. I want to make sure I listen to it. As long as I can stand to listen to my own voice, that's usually the hardest part.
So. Well, once I edit, I have to do that to myself for like a couple more hours. So it's
I'm sorry.
No, not you. Me, not you. I wasn't insulting you.
No, I'm just sorry that you have to listen to me for that much longer.
It's all good. And then I listen to it in the car after I edit it just to make sure everything came out right and boost my numbers.
Yeah, well, that's cool. Well, I make sure I listen and I'll post it on Facebook and see if some of my 1974 friends might want to tune in and see if their memories are about the same.
So I appreciate the time that you've given today and the stories. They're great. I love, like I said, now I got to see images of you back in 1974, you know, that time frame, because I just can't imagine leisure suits and you know, all these kinds of things.
I'll take a look around and see if I can find something and show you. I know I've got them somewhere. It's just a matter of knowing where they are. But I'll find something and show it to you. It'll be fun.
Well, it's been true pleasure. I'm going to go ahead and read the outro here. And you want to stick around after, we'll chat for a few more minutes. And then we'll be done for the day.
All right. Sounds good.
Thank you for being here. So, cowabunga, time travelers, that's going to do it for this ride in the Tubular Time Machine. Thanks for cruising back through the raddest years with us. We hope you had as much fun as we did cranking up the nostalgia, reliving those gnarly tunes, iconic movies, epic, well, not in this case, video games, and all the pop culture goodness that made growing up totally awesome. Major shout out and mondo thanks to my weekly co-host for another righteous trip down memory lane. Your stories and vibes make this retro journey even more bodacious. Want to keep the party going? Hit us up on social media. We're talking Facebook, Instagram, maybe even a little MySpace just for the LOLs. And don't forget to cruise over to tubulartimemachine.com where you can catch past episodes, send us your memories, or suggest a year you want us to fire up in the flux capacitor for next week. And hey, if you're digging the ride and want to help us keep this retro machine rolling, head over to buymeacoffee.com/Mr. Raz. Your support helps fuel future episodes and keeps the good vibes alive. Until next time, keep your mixtapes fresh, your VHS rewound, and your vibes totally tubular. Catch you on the flip side, dude and dudettes.
Hey there, dude and dudettes. It's time to rewind from neon nights to that vintage vibe. Dates, tapes, arcades, butterfly clips. We're cruising the past with totally racked tips.